chapter 29, one thing I might mention back in chapter 28, you begin a series of six woes that are enumerated here. The first one in verse 1 of chapter 28, then the second one here where we're beginning in chapter 29, the first verse. Woe to Ariel, the city where David dwelt. Add you year to year, let them kill sacrifices, yet I'll distress Ariel, and there'll be heaviness and sorrow, and it'll be unto me as Ariel. And of course, it's quite obvious the key in understanding this is the word Ariel, and yet it's obvious it's the city where David dwelt, so it must be another name for Jerusalem or Zion. And of course, it literally is, because the word is tied in with the altar of God, of course, the temple being there in Jerusalem, on Mount Moriah, there on Zion, the city of David. So here he is symbolically speaking of Jerusalem as the place where the temple and the altar and the sacrifices were all being performed. And of course, it's a verse dealing with the holy days. The terminology here from year to year, literally talking about the feasts and their cycles from year to year, and the offering of sacrifices at these feast occasions. And yet he's saying God is going to turn the festive occasion, the joy of the feasts and the sacrifices, into heaviness and sorrow. And that actually God is going to cause the same Jerusalem to be like an altar that's going to have sacrifices all about it. So as the literal altar had sacrifices about it, when you gather all these armies together around Jerusalem, there are going to be sacrifices there, like blood reaching up to the horses' bridles in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. So that's what he's depicting here in the first couple of verses. The same descriptiveness of Ariel you'll find back in Ezekiel 43 and verse 15, showing again the harmony of all these prophets. Many of the things you find in one, you'll find in the other. So the altar shall be 4 cubits. And of course, here is the Hebrew word is Herod, the mountain of God. And from the altar and upward shall be 4 horns. And of course, there the word is exactly the same in the Hebrew, Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, as back here in Isaiah 29. In verse 3, God says, I'll camp against you round about, and will lay siege against you with a mount, and I'll raise forts against you, and you'll be brought down. So instead of the loud clamor and the excitement of feast marchers and the music, instead of that, they'll be brought down, and they'll speak out of the ground as if it's just a familiar spirit peeping or muttering. So he's contrasting the sober, sad, quiet voice of the familiar spirit to the happy, joyous, prosperous, festive occasion that had been. You'll speak out of the ground, your speech shall be low out of the dust, your voice shall be as one that has a familiar spirit. Out of the ground, your speech shall whisper out of the dust. And now God is going to talk about what he's going to do to the powers that are going to be used to punish Israel. Moreover, the multitude of your strangers shall be like small dust, and the multitude of the terrible ones, the tyrants that are coming against you. So it shows again they're not just one country. It's not just speaking about the country of Judah being overthrown by one smaller country around it. But the powers that are going to bring down Israel are a multitude of strangers, a multitude of terrible ones. And then they're going to be like chaff all of a sudden when God punishes them and takes them away. It'll be in an instant, suddenly. So this power is going to go from triumph to disaster very quickly. And it's going to be sudden when God intervenes and punishes that power that brings Israel down. You shall be visited of the eternal hosts. And here he's speaking again, like verse 5, to the captors, to the nations of Europe. You'll be visited of the eternal host with thunder, with earthquake, with great noise. So Christ is going to come back and intervene with a shout, the voice of the archangel, the trump of God, the earthquake. So this enemy, these multitude of strangers and multitude of terrible ones, that's who the you goes back to from verse 6, God is then going to visit them with Armageddon, with thunder and earthquakes and great noise, storm, tempest, the flame of devouring fire, in the multitude of all the nations. Notice that's plural. The power that's going to overthrow Israel in the end time is not one country. The multitude of all the nations that fight against Ariel, even all that fight against her and her munition and that distress her, shall be as a dream of a night vision, like a dream just suddenly vanishes and disappears. So that's what's going to happen to this multitude of nations at Armageddon fighting against God's temple city. Then they're going to be suddenly vanished, just like a dream of a night vision. And it shall be, even as when an hungry man dreams, and behold, he eats, but he awakens, and his soul is empty. So they're not even going to have the time to enjoy their conquest when they bring Israel down. They're going to last so shortly after that, maybe a couple of years, maybe 3.5 years at the most. It's written in the book for the latter days. So it's written for our time. It wasn't written just for history back in the old days or for prophecy just immediately to be fulfilled. But all of this has been written before them in a tablet, noted in a book for the latter days. Now he comes back to the description of Israel and says, this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law. That's a pretty good description, isn't it? You talk to Protestants or Catholics about hearing the law, and they're not going to listen. Now, Catholics will hear the Ten Commandments, so will Lutherans and Episcopalians, but you start quoting statutes and judgments, and they're not going to listen to them. And, of course, Church of Christ and Baptists and Presbyterians aren't going to listen to any law, period. It's all been done away with. So the people of God are described in the latter days as rebellious, lying children that won't hear the law. That doesn't sound like China to me, or Japan. And it doesn't sound like... Who's that sound like? Rebellious, lying children that won't hear the law. And yet they claim to believe in this book. They claim to go by the Bible. They claim to be the people of God, the Christian world. And yet God likens his people in the last days as people that won't hear the law. They say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. So if we think they're going to listen, we're going to be surprised, because they're not going to listen. This shows they're not going to listen. They say to anybody God sends to warn them, don't prophesy. Now you might want to tie in the parallel with that back in Jeremiah in chapter 11, and it's even in the minor prophets as well. Jeremiah 11, therefore thus says the Eternal of the men of Anathoth, one of Jeremiah's cities, that seek your life, saying, prophesy not in the name of the Eternal, that you die not by our hand. So the time's coming when the people of Israel are going to be so stirred and moved by the crying of God's people that they're going to say, you'd better quit prophesying in the name of the Eternal, or we're going to put you to death and think they do God a service. Verse 21. Jeremiah 11, verse 21. Now let's see if I can find that one in Amos. I ought to be able to think that's in Amos. Chapter 7 of Amos is another parallel. It's kind of interesting, too, that almost always when God raised up a prophet, then you had somebody that came along as a false prophet to try to contradict what the prophet was saying, to keep people mixed up and to keep them from listening. Verse 10, Amos 7, then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent to Jeroboam, king of Israel, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear all his words.
So notice what they do. They actually blame the prophet that's telling what all's going to happen for helping to cause it to happen. Well, if you hadn't been bad-mouthing all these years and getting people out of good old historical Christianity, you know, you're a party to this. You brought all this on this nation. That's what they did here. Amos has conspired against you. The land isn't able to bear all his words. Thus says Amos, Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel shall surely be led away captive out of their own land. And yet, you know, that's what message we're going to have to give in the end time, that Israel's going to be brought down. Israel's going to surely be led away captive out of their own land. And whoever that last king of Israel is going to die by the sword. Well, also Amaziah said to Amos, Oh, you seer, you go and flee you away into the land of Judah. And there you eat your bread and prophesy there. In other words, you sound like you're more Jew than anything to me anyway. Get out of Israel and get down there among all the rest of the Jews. You're a Jew anyway. Well, that sounds kind of like that could be parallel today, you know. Keep the Sabbath and holy days and tithing, follow all those Jewish food laws. What are you doing here anyway? Won't you get down there into Judah where you belong? You're just Jews anyway. So that may well be how we get shipped out of Israel. Oh, you seer, go flee you away into the land of Judah, and there eat bread and prophesy there. But don't prophesy again anymore at Bethel. It's the king's chapel. It's the king's court. Well, then Amos answered and said to Amaziah, I wasn't a prophet. I wasn't even a prophet's son. I was just a herdman. I was a gatherer of wild figs. And the Eternal took me as I followed the flock, and the Eternal said to me, Go, prophesy unto my people Israel. Now, therefore, you hear the word of the Eternal. You say, Prophesy not against Israel, and don't drop your word against the house of Isaac. Isaacsons, don't do that. So notice the parallel in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Amos. God's servants are going to be told to shut up, to hush. Don't prophesy. You're causing difficulty. You're going to have a part in bringing on us all this nonsense you're trying to say is coming on us. So then God inspired Amos to get specific about this man individually. And he said, Your wife's going to be a harlot in the city, and your sons and your daughters are going to fall by the sword, and your land's going to be divided by a lion, and you're going to die in a polluted land because you stood up to go against God's prophecies and God's warning, and you've tried to thwart God's warning by false prophecies. So that's what's going to happen to you. And Israel is surely going to go into captivity forth of this land, just like we've been saying. So over and over again, he has that warning about not listening, that they're not going to hearken. Well, back to verse 10 of chapter 30. They say to the seers, See not. To the prophets, prophesy not, unless you prophesy smooth things, make things easier for us. Don't tell us about all those tithing laws and all those holy days and food laws and all those details of God's way. That's too hard, you know. Well, that's what Rehoboam did way back in the earlier days, Jeroboam. So many times, you know, they tried to make it easier for the people. And we've had men doing that in the last 10 years, saying, well, let's make it easier for the people. Well, we can't do that. We can't speak smooth things and prophesy deceits. Now they say, get you out of the way. In other words, stop preaching to us. Get out of the way. Get out of here. Don't be confronting us and saying all these things to us. Turn aside out of the path. Cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. In other words, we don't want any more words from the Holy One of Israel. You keep telling us what the Holy One of Israel says. And you're always in front of us with these warnings from the Holy One of Israel. So get that out from in front of us. Wherefore, thus says the Holy One of Israel, because you despise this word, and trust in oppression, and perverseness, and stay thereon, somehow you think you're still going to be able to live as you please, and live immorally, and go on claiming your Christian nations, and you're despising the warning of God's words. Therefore, this iniquity shall be to you as a breach ready to fall, swelling out in a high wall. In other words, if you look at a wall, and all of a sudden some bricks begin to pooch out a little bit, and before you know it, they're stuck out a little further, and it's just a warning that before long the whole wall is going to come smashing down. So that's the way God likens this iniquity. It's like a breach beginning to break out in a wall, swelling out in a high wall, and then all of a sudden, look how God describes the collapse of the wall around Israel, whose breaking comes suddenly at an instant. That's how fast it's going to happen. Now, we were visiting with one of the ladies in Washington that works in the governmental buildings, in the budget. And she said, boy, oh boy, if people had a job like she does where they could really see what the budget is, they'd get panic-stricken. She said, I don't know what's holding things up. Said, I don't know what's holding everything afloat. So the least little thing, and it could all come smashing down. Well, that's what God describes here. A breach ready to fall, swelling out in a high wall, whose breaking is going to come suddenly at an instant. And finally, it's going to be broken like the breaking of the potter's vessel that's broken in pieces. He'll not spare, and it's going to be broken so totally, there'll not be found in the bursting of it, assured to take fire from the hearth, or to take water withal out of the pit. Well, that's some description, you know. The potter's vessel, God always likens Israel to the potter's vessel, and God's the potter. The potter's clay, that's why he wondered maybe in Daniel 11, where it talks about iron mixed with clay, the potter's clay, that maybe some of the nations of Israel may well end up being tied in with the nations of the beast power. But anyway, here Israel again is likened to the potter's vessel. But when they're broken, it's going to be broken so thoroughly into such small pieces, you couldn't even find one little piece of potter's clay to hold water in for a drink or to put fire in, to carry it to start another fire. For thus says the Lord Eternal, the Holy One of Israel, in returning and rest you'll be saved. So notice here, the millennium is when Israel is going to get turned back to God and get salvation. In the Sabbath rest. In the 1,000-year Sabbath rest. The day at the end of man's 6 days. The 6,000 years. People say, well, I don't see where you get that 6,000-year plan. Well, I don't see where people can keep from getting that 6,000-year plan. It's mentioned over and over and over. The very rest of the Sabbath is all the way through shown to be the time of the millennium, 1,000 years of rest of Israel. In returning and rest shall you, house of Israel, be saved, in quietness and in confidence. So when they're brought back to their land in the millennium, they're going to be brought back in quietness and in confidence, and that's going to be their strength. And that's what God wanted to do before, but they would not. No, you said, no, we're going to flee on horses. So apparently, because Assyria was noted for their cavalry and all of their horses, and they had very little in Israel, they thought Egypt would be their deliverance because they were even more famous for their horses. So the false confidence the people had is, oh boy, we're going to flee upon horses. And yet, even in the last days, when you read about the battles back in Revelation, they're talking about horses and horsemen. And men on horses. So the parallel is there again. Israel's going to have a false security, trusting in allies and lovers that they've bought off, and they're going to think, oh, we'll escape it. We'll flee on horses. But you're going to flee, all right. We'll ride on the swift. Therefore, the ones that pursue you are even going to be swifter. 1,000 shall flee at the rebuke of one. Now, all that goes right back to the laws of the Bible back in the first 5 books of Moses, because God said if we went his way, then one of us would put 1,000 to flight. But instead of that, 1,000 of us are fleeing at the rebuke of one. That's turning it upside down. That's not what the law said back there in Deuteronomy. It should have been the other way around. In Deuteronomy 28:25 or Leviticus 26:8, one of us should put 1,000 to flight. But that isn't the way it's going to be. 1,000 of us are going to flee at the rebuke of one. At the rebuke of 5, they'll flee. Till you're going to be left as a beacon on the top of a mountain, as an ensign on a hill. Now, the word beacon here is a word that should be translated flagpole or the mast of a ship. It's translated the mast of a ship in Ezekiel 27 and verse 5. Also in Isaiah 33 and verse 23, the very same word, toren in Hebrew, is translated mast of a ship. So what's going to be left of Israel is going to be lonely and widely separated and scattered, like the loneliness of a mast on a ship, or like the loneliness of a flagpole on top of a hill and nothing there. So you're going to be left as a flagpole on the top of a mountain. Therefore will the Eternal wait, that he may be gracious to you, and therefore he'll be exalted, that he may have mercy upon you. For the Eternal is the God of judgment, blessed are all they that wait for him. So now you begin to get the millennial restoration picture once again. After God has allowed them to be punished, and only a tithe of them's left, only a small remnant like a beacon on the top of a mountain, then God has waited, and now he's going to intervene and be gracious to them. And now he's going to be exalted. He's going to become their God. And he'll have mercy on them. And they'll be brought back to their land, and then God will be their God, exalted. And the waiting is over with, and now he's gracious, because he is a God of judgment. And all they that wait on him are going to be blessed. Now there are three of these beatitudes, as you might call them, in the book of Isaiah. So you're going to find that actually Christ probably got the idea or the parallel or the pattern of giving the Beatitudes in the New Testament right here out of Isaiah, because you'll find three of them here as you go through. Isaiah 32:20 is the next one we'll run on to, and Isaiah 56 verse 2. Of course, you could translate, blessed are they, oh, the happiness of all of them that do this and that. For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. So here he comes right back to Ariel again, and people restored and brought back from their scatteredness, their loneliness. They'll dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. They'll weep no more. He'll be very gracious to you at the voice of your cry. So you see, once they cry out in repentance, once they cry out to God and say, we're sorry, we've misrepresented you, and we haven't really lived your book. So once they cry, then God's going to be very gracious. When he shall hear it, then he'll answer them. And though the Lord give you the bread of adversity, and the same Hebrew term back in 1 Kings 22 and verse 27 is the prison diet, the scarcity of someone being fed the very minimum in prison. So that's how bad Israel's going to end up in their captivity. They're going to end up eating the diet of the prisoner. In fact, God says you'll eat unclean things in the land of Assyria. Which means what? Crow and catfish and unclean things that we shouldn't even be eating. Maybe rats and things that only prisoners would ever eat. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers from this time in the future aren't going to be removed anymore into the corner, but your eyes are going to see your teachers. And your ears are going to hear, so hear teachers plural. As a matter of fact, I think it's the Brother Sonsino brings out here that the word teachers there is actually one of the plural forms for God. Yes, it's in the Companion Bible mentions the word teachers here is a plural form of majesty. Your great teachers. Parallel, obviously, to God, the great teacher. And yet here it's plural. Yet your great teachers. A term of majesty. They're not going to be removed into the corner anymore. God won't be far off hiding himself anymore. We won't be cut off from God anymore and him be way off. Your eyes shall see your teachers, and your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk you in it. So here, sons of God, born of God, spirit teachers, intervening in people's lives before they go too far one way or the other. Now, of course, it's always an interesting discussion. How far is God going to let people go in the millennium? People be allowed to lie and steal and Well, they won't be allowed to kill, because scriptures say they won't hurt nor destroy in all of my holy mountain. But people can't build character if they're not allowed to make mistakes. If they're not allowed to go the way of humanity, then how can they repent? But apparently, what he's saying here is that you begin to go the one way or the other, but before you get too far gone, then the teachers stop you. Your ears hear a word behind you saying, now, wait a minute, that's not the way, here's the way, walk you in it, when you turn to the right hand. So you see, there's still a free moral agency that people are allowed to learn the hard way if they want, but not to the point of killing or bloodshed. You shall defile also the covering of your graven images of silver, the ornament of your molten images of gold. You'll cast them away as a minstrel's cloth. You'll say unto it, get you hence. Now, it's kind of a puzzle to me how the Bible, knowing it's Holy Scripture, knowing it's God-breathed, knowing that it's infallible and it's spiritual meat, and yet God uses some rather frank terminology at times. So it makes you wonder why man, maybe it's because of our false religion, that we've built up a righteous ideas about what righteousness is. And yet, you know, humans make crass jokes in certain areas. And yet, I don't know that God does that. And yet, in other areas, God's quite plain-spoken and frank and blunt. You know, here God talks about something that is normal and physical and scientific and natural and something He's created in women, and He just comes right out and words it. And yet, humans that are more righteous or holy than God might take offense at some things the Bible says. In fact, one guy wrote a whole book just trying to show you how untasteful the Bible was, that it was a coarse book, that it used bad terminology. That why, he said, I wouldn't want my kids reading that book. It's got a lot of gory things in it, and a lot of crass and coarse things in it. Now, maybe the same person makes crass jokes about sex or about elimination or about races or about different things, but, you know, when God talks about things that are scientific and natural and human and normal, then people take exception to the Bible. It's a guy who wrote a book called The Bible Unmasked, and I got a copy of it and started to read it and got so sick of it, I just put it away. So if you want to buy a copy, I can sell you one cheap. But you ever notice how frank and honest God is in the Bible? There are areas that I don't think if God just comes right out and says it, right away you think, well, I hope that's a mistranslation. And you look it up and it isn't. As a matter of fact, there are some places that men have been embarrassed to translate the Bible the way it really is written. Because, you know, back when old Simon Magus tried to buy the gift of giving the Holy Spirit to people that he'd lay hands on, if you read that in the Greek, you might get embarrassed as a Protestant because he just said, to hell with you and your money. I mean, he meant it in the sense that you say, well, you've got that attitude of buying spiritual gifts, you're going to end up in hell. But you know, in the Greek, that's God just, as we say today, let it all hang out. You know, he just said, that's what Peter told him. You and your money go to perdition. Well, you wouldn't dare translate that way. Can you imagine little old Protestant ladies opening their Bible and reading that way? They'd be dumbfounded and aghast at God. Well, anyway, maybe you can give me some ideas on that. But it's always striking to me the way God is just plain spoken in the Bible. You know, God's even funny if people would let it come out. But they're not going to let it come out. But you know, there are places like back in the book of Job where the man came and telling him about what all had happened, and he said, I'm only escaped by the skin of my teeth. Now, who ever heard of that, skin of your teeth? God has a sense of humor if people had let it come out in the scriptures, but they're not going to do that. You know, there's one place where God said somebody was half dead. Now, how can you be half dead? But there are a lot of stories in the Bible that are rather humorous if you really let them come out that way. Okay, let's get back here where we were. Verse 22, you'll defile the covering of your graven images of silver. Well, in other words, you're going to burn your Christmas trees and stomp on the Semiramis bulbs and everything else, you know. You're going to defile the covering of your graven images of silver. What are graven images of silver? The ornament of your molten images of gold. The church domes and church steeples and what is that? It's not talking about, I don't know of any churches that have idols of gold and silver in the Baptist, Presbyterian, you know, in the churches that are Israel's churches. You'll cast them away as a menstruous cloth. And really, the term cast away isn't very well translated here either. It literally means you'll reject. You'll be embarrassed at them. You'll throw them away, rejecting them and embarrassed by them. You'll say to it, you get hence. Then he'll give the rain of your seed. That's the early rain that comes after the crops are planted. That you'll sow the ground with all, and the bread of the increase of the earth, it'll be fat and plenteous in that day. There again is that key phrase. You don't always circle that. In that day, your cattle shall feed in large pastures. The oxen likewise and the young asses that ear the ground, and that's again poor translation. It literally means plow the ground from an Anglo-Saxon term, earian, Latin term, arare, but it literally means plow the ground, they're going to eat clean provender, which has been winnowed with the shovel and with the fan. And you know, the word clean there isn't very well translated. Maybe your Bible in the margin uses the word leavened or savory. Well, it literally is the word shamits in Hebrew that means salted or acid. So it's a special mixing of provender. Actually, the word provender here is the Hebrew word Belial, which means a mixture. So they mixed beans and barley and oats and vetches, and then they put salt in it to give it savory, and that's what he's talking about. The choicest feed that you can feed your animals. So it's kind of unusual. God would be an agricultural specialist and tell you how to have the choicest feed. Mix and salt, which has been winnowed with a shovel. There will be upon every high mountain and upon every high hill rivers and streams of waters in the day of the great slaughter when the towers fall. In other words, when God brings down those armies at Armageddon, his feet are going to stand on the Mount of Olives, and you're going to have rivers flowing out of all these hills and high mountains. No more desolation and desert and drought. Moreover, the light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun shall be sevenfold as the light of 7 days. What is that talking about? What's going to happen to the earth's atmosphere that actually the reflection of the moon would become so much brighter, and the brightness of the sun would be so much brighter? Is that just the glory of God and the angels descending? Is that just the changing over of all the sons of God into spirit beings? Might be. Is that a scientific description of something that's going to happen in nature that's going to make the magnification of the light? I'm not sure. Is that some weaponry that people might put out in space to magnify the sun's heat down on earth to scorch men and destroy men by modern weaponry that would be stationed in space and multiply the light of the sun? Might be. You know, you can't nail that down. Which is it? I don't know. Maybe all of it. Maybe only one of them. I know it's true. I know the light of the moon is going to be as the light of the sun. That's what it says. And I know the light of the sun is going to be sevenfold. Now, why it's going to be that way, and whether it's going to be literal or symbolical, I'm not for sure. In the day that the Eternal binds up the breach of his people. In other words, when he puts the punishment of the 7 last plagues on the powers that punished Israel. When he binds up the breach. When he heals the stroke of their wound. In other words, when Christ comes back and intervenes and destroys the destroyers of the earth and regathers Israel and brings them back to their land, that's the day when he binds up the breach of his people. All that's on the 7th trumpet. Behold, the name of the Eternal comes from far, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation, and his tongue as a devouring fire. So here God comes back with judgment on the human empires, the beast power, and the Asiatic hordes. The seven last plagues, his anger. His lips are full of indignation, his tongue a devouring fire, pronouncing judgments of fire and destruction on human empires. And his breath, as an overflowing stream, shall reach to the midst of the neck, to sift the nations with the sieve of vanity. And there will be a bridle in the jaws of the people. And there again, that is better translated in the Jewish translation. Here's the better translation. His breath is as an overflowing stream. In other words, God's utterances coming out of his mouth are spreading all out like a flood of a river flooding all the land around it. So instead of God's words in the past just dealing with Israel, now God's breath spreads out over all of man's numbers, man's floods, or multitudes of peoples. His breath is as an overflowing stream that divides even into the neck, to sift the nations with a sieve of destruction, and a bridle that causes to err shall be in the jaws of the peoples. So all of a sudden, the peoples of the earth, as if Satan just got a hold of them with a bridle, leading them head on to destroy man off the earth, and Christ comes back and his breath utters judgments on all of the nations of the earth, spreading out like rivers, breaking out over a river's banks. You shall have a song as in the night when a holy solemnity is kept. There again, you'd never know, that's the Hebrew word CHAQ, that's a word for holy day, feast. So here again, in these few verses, another reference to God's holy days. So now, as he described earlier, the joy of the holy days being taken away with punishment, now they're restored back to their holy day. You'll have a festival song, an Exodus song. You'll have a victory song. As in the night, when is a night when a holy solemnity is kept? Well, I don't think I can remember one except the night to be much remembered. And that's what he's talking about here. He's talking about unleavened bread season. It's talking about the joy of finally being brought out of Egypt and brought out of sin and having all the leavening put out. So the victory song in the day of restoration is like that night of the night to be much remembered. The holy festival being kept, gladness of heart, as when one goes with his musical instruments up to the holy days, coming up to the mountain of the eternal, to the mighty one, the rock. There again, the rock of Israel. The Hebrew word just means rock. But look how they destroy the holy days in their translating, everywhere they can. You're going to be dumbfounded one of these years when you find out how many times the holy days are mentioned in Scripture, where they've been hidden, deliberately, mistranslated. It's hard to imagine how many times it's happened. And the Eternal shall cause the voice of his glory. You notice how Protestants worship, instead of worshiping God and his plan and his truth, they want to worship idols or worship something physical. So they're going to have his glorious voice. Well, it isn't his glorious voice. It's his voice describing and bringing and proclaiming glory that'll be heard, and shall show the lighting down of his arm. Lighting down, that's just old Hebrew for dropping or lowering, the descent. In other words, his hand is coming down. He's bringing down his hand on man's civilization and earth. With the indignation of his anger, with the flame of the devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and hailstones. So that's how Christ is coming back. With intervention, with supernatural punishment, and with destruction on the destroyers. His arm is going to come down on them with these things. For through the voice of the Eternal shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. So all of a sudden he comes back again to tell you who the power was that punished Israel. The Assyrian. And then God is going to punish him. at Armageddon, and in every place where the grounded staff shall pass, in other words, the rod of correction, everywhere that that rod of correction has passed, the Eternal is going to lay upon this beast power. It's going to cause it to rest upon him. Actually, it says in the margin, it isn't going to just come down once and depart. He's going to cause this grounded staff to rest upon him. He's going to be kept down, not just punished once and lifted, but kept down. It'll be with tabrets and harps. There again, the word tabrets, the word for drums. And in battles of shaking, he'll fight with it. For Tophet is ordained of old. Now here's a term that you can look up. Was a place in hell where they passed their children through the fire. You might jot down Jeremiah 7 and verse 31. They have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my heart. So there God describes one of the abominations that Israel got into, where they actually began to follow the heathen and worship the god of fire, and they built high places in one of the areas right in the valley of the sons of Hinnom in hell. And that's where they practiced this wretched religion of burning their sons and their daughters. Can you imagine anybody being that demon misled? You know, they actually thought if you sacrificed your oldest son or daughter, then that would ward off any fire god, and you wouldn't have to worry about fire in your life from then on. But if you didn't, you may never have a house that didn't end up being struck with lightning and destroyed by fire again and again and again. But if you just burn your oldest son or daughter, then you had peace the rest of your life. Who could believe that kind of wretchedness? But that's what they did in the Valley of Hinnom, burning their sons and daughters in that fire. You can find that again in 2 Kings 23:10. I won't turn and read that one, but now God is talking about hell has been prepared for the devil and his angels. Jesus said, remember in Matthew, now God says hell is ordained from long time back, yea, for the beast and the false prophet. Just like the book of Revelation says, the beast and the false prophet are going to be cast into that lake of fire. And sure enough, even Isaiah knew that Tophet was ordained of old for the king. That beast power that led the Assyrian to punish Israel, that king is going to be dealt with by God supernaturally and be thrown into Tophet, this place of fire. He has made it deep and large. The pile thereof is fire and much wood. The breath of the Eternal, like a stream of brimstone, does kindle it. And it's kind of unusual, you know, that Rome sits on a bed of sulfur and all kinds of mineral deposits underneath on those seven hills that will erupt into a Tophet Gehenna fire that you can't imagine. But look at this. The breath of the Eternal is what's going to kindle it. When he comes back and utters the judgment on the beast and the false prophet, then into that lake of fire they're cast. Well, what harmony between Isaiah and even Revelation? Well, chapter 31, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help. Now that must be applying in our day. Who all is going to go down to Egypt for help? The British? The Swiss? French? The Dutch? Belgians? Who all is going to go down to Egypt for help? America? Norway? Sweden? Who all is going to end up doing that? Well, the British don't have as much oil in the North Sea as they thought they did. But God warns. You know, I noticed in the bookstore the other day that somebody's got another book out on prophecy, and it talks about the oil and the Middle East crisis and how oil is going to play a part in the Middle East crisis and what it's going to have for Europe and America and Japan. And I thought, well, that guy's been reading our literature. Look at all of that now. Here's another book out about the same thing. Well, God says, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help, that stay on horses. There's, they didn't have that many horses themselves, so they trusted in these horses of Egypt. In Isaiah 36, you might jump ahead and maybe even jot that down in your margin there by verse 1. But here he shows this trusting in Egypt and the battle with Assyria, and he says in verse 8, "Now therefore, give pledges, I pray you, to my master the king of Assyria, and I'll give you 2,000 horses, if you be able on your part to set riders on them." So cavalry in Israel was so rare, the Assyrians weren't even sure they'd know how to use them anyway. But they said, "I'll give you these horses if that's what you're worried about having a need of." Well, they didn't have that much in the way of horses, so they trusted in the Egyptian horses. They trusted in chariots because the Egyptians had many horses and chariots, and in horsemen because they're very strong. But they looked not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Eternal. So God's people, once again, are condemned because they trust in human reasoning and human allies. And yet he, the Holy One of Israel, that's the last proper noun back up above, is wise and will bring evil. So you could trust in the Eternal. He's wise, but since you wouldn't, now he's going to bring evil and will not call back his words. You could have had God call back his words. If you'd have hearkened to God and given yourselves over to the Assyrians, then God would have called back his words. But since you didn't, then God isn't going to call back his words, but will arise against the house of the evildoers and against the help of them that work iniquity. So God's going to rise up both against Israel, the house of the evildoers, and against the Egyptians that they look to for their help. Now the Egyptians are men, they're not God. So apparently in the end time, people are going to look to the Egyptians as if they're, that's the only thing you can do. It's absolutely essential. You actually have to. Well, what all are those Arabs going to buy with all that money they got from all that oil? And they keep discovering more oil and more oil all along over there. Well, God says the Egyptians are men. They're not God. Their horses are flesh, not spirit. Sure, they've got multitudes of horses and chariots. When the Eternal shall stretch out his hand, both he that helps Egypt shall fall, and he that is helped Israel shall fall down, and they're going to all fail together. In other words, the same European power that brings down Israel is going to end up bringing down Egypt right afterward. So as soon as they bring Israel down in the fifth seal, then right away in the fifth trumpet, they're going to bring Egypt down. Both he that helped shall fall and he that's helped shall fall down. And they'll all fail together. For thus has the Eternal spoken to me, like as the lion and the young lion roaring on his prey, when a multitude of shepherds call forth against him, he'll not be afraid of their voice, nor abase himself for the noise of them. In other words, you can't have shepherds scare away lions just by their utterances. So shall the Eternal of hosts come down to fight for Mount Zion and for the hill thereof. So right at the last, God is going to intervene to spare his holy place where he's going to set up God's government in the millennium. The Eternal of hosts at the seventh trumpet intervenes and comes down to fight at Armageddon right at the time the armies are all gathered at Mount Zion and for the Mount Moriah and Mount of Jerusalem there, Mount Zion. As birds flying, so will the Eternal of hosts defend Jerusalem. So the powers that are gathered around it are going to fly away like birds flying away when they're spooked from their food. Defending also, he'll deliver it. And passing over, he'll preserve it. And here again is another reference to the holy days, because this is the very Hebrew word for the Passover. In other words, as the birds hovering, protecting their nest with their wings, that's the way God is going to protect Israel with their wings. And the word defend here is really the word shield. God will put his wings over like a shield. The same thing's found many times in Isaiah. Chapter 37, verse 35, same word. Chapter 38, verse 6 is the same word. And the only other place it's mentioned in prophecy is Zechariah. But the same wings of shielding the people, Zechariah 9:15 and Zechariah 12:8. We might turn and read those. Zechariah 9:15. The Eternal of hosts shall defend them. They shall devour and subdue with sling stones. They'll drink and make a noise as through wine. So here he's talking about defending and shielding them.
See, Zechariah 12 and verse 8. In that day shall the Eternal defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. He that's feeble among them at that day shall be as David. So he's not just talking about the word defending here is shielding, sheltering them, putting the wings over them. Now, when it comes to the word passing over, it's really the same exact word for Passover, Exodus 12, 13. So, in a way, God is going to pass over the punishment and shield them with their wings and defend them and pass over their guilt and bring them back. So it's another reference to the holy day, the Passover. Now in verse 6, here Israel's going to repent. Turn you. That's a Hebrew word that in the Greek would be translated repent. Turn you to him from whom the children of Israel have deeply revolted. For in that day, there again the key terminology showing the day of the Lord, in that day every man shall cast away his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which your hands have made unto you for a sin. There again, the word cast away means despise and reject, like we read in chapter 30, verse 22. You might want to put that out in the margins of parallel terminology. It's the same in Isaiah 2 and verse 20. You'll reject and despise your idols of silver and gold, including all the religious relics and Christmas and Easter and all the pagan uses of silver and gold in their rituals, which your hands have made to you for a sin. Then shall the Assyrian fall with a sword, not of a mighty man. So when the king of Assyria falls, it's going to be by God. It's going to be supernatural. Tophet was prepared and ordained of old for the king. It's been prepared. So from of old, it's been prepared for the beast and the false prophet. And then finally, the Assyrian is going to fall with a sword, but not of a mighty man. The sword, not of a mean man. The sword of God is going to devour him. He's going to flee from the sword, and his young men are going to be discomfited. Really, the Hebrew margin, or Hebrew word means tributary. They're not going to be destroyed. They're not going to be devastated or wiped out or obliterated. His young men shall be tributary, serving under others at the beginning of the millennium. And he, the Assyrian, is going to pass over and see God's stronghold, and he's going to be struck with fear. And the princes of these nations of Europe are going to be afraid of the end sign, says the Eternal, whose fire is in Zion and his furnace in Jerusalem. So going all the way back there to Ariel again, the altar and the fire and the sacrifices. Now all of a sudden, when the power that comes down to Megiddo begins to see the stronghold of God, he's going to be struck with fear. And so are the princes who are going to be afraid. So here is the end sign, God, Christ, coming back in the seventh trumpet with glory and power. Then he's going to have the fire of his devouring fire in Zion. And that furnace of God devouring the enemy is going to be around Jerusalem. Now, after that happens, the king is going to reign in righteousness. So these chapters have a sequence that tie right in greatly. So now, a king reigns in righteousness. Now, you know what the great scholars say if you look this up in the commentary? Hezekiah. Well, I'll never believe that's Hezekiah. That's ridiculous, you know. You read the whole context. He's not talking about Hezekiah. He's talking about the supernatural punishment of the Assyrian. You think Hezekiah did that? Verse 8, not on your life he didn't do that. And I don't remember reading back there by Hezekiah's time the fulfillment of these things described there in chapter 31. Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness. Now, God probably didn't say the king there. He just let man go off with his great brain and get off the deep end and miss the boat. This is talking about the Son of God, Christ,
the king that's going to reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment. Well, Christ isn't alone in that new government. They're princes. Other sons of God ruling with the king in judgment and righteousness. Now, any of these king, this king or the princes, these are a man that is a hiding place from the wind, a covert from the tempest. They're like rivers of water in a dry place. They're like a shadow of a great rock in a weary land. That's talking about all of these who are made rulers, all of these who are made kings and intervening and helping God in His government. These people are as a hiding place from the wind. They're shelter from this storm that's been going on in man's world. The eyes of them that see shall not be dim. The ears of them that hear shall hearken. So now spiritual enlightenment comes to everybody again. People's deaf ears and blinded eyes are changed, and now people's eyes see clearly who they are and why they're here, and that God is God, and this is His Word, and we're to live by it. So now eyes are seeing clearly, and ears are hearing and hearkening. The heart also of the rash shall understand knowledge, and the tongue of the stammerers shall be ready to speak plainly. So here God's just describing the blindness that's been on man for these 6,000 years, but now also, all of a sudden, carnal, unconverted, rebellious human beings are going to be converted. The vile person shall be no more called liberal. And I know one of our ministers in the past got carried away with the sermons out of here against liberals. Well, you better look up the word liberal before you do that, because you might get yourself in trouble if you don't, because the word really is talking about noble, nobility. So no longer will someone who's vile be called noble. In other words, we won't call adulteresses miss anymore. And we won't call murderers and thieves Mr. and Honorable and Your Honor. And, you know, if they're crooked judges or crooked whatever, they're going to be called what they were, you know. Crooked judges, adulterers, adulteresses, liars, thieves. So no longer will a vile person, in order to get prestige or favor, be called noble. No longer a miser, somebody that's materialistic and a skin flint, he's not going to be called bountiful, someone that just hoards up everything for himself, that just puts aside money and tries to take over the whole world economically. No longer will these covetous misers be called bountiful, because the vile person will speak villainy, and his heart will work iniquity, and practice hypocrisy and utter error against the Eternal, to make empty the soul of the hungry. There again is another word about soul. How can your soul be made empty? Or how can your soul be made hungry? If it's an immortal spiritual essence inside of you, it can't know hunger. But that's what it says. To make empty the soul of the hungry, he'll cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. The instruments also of the miser, the covetous, are evil. He devises wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words. Think about how many wealthy people have actually done that. Devising some wicked device to get money from everybody and to continue to hoard it up and store it up. What percentage of Americans own 90% of the wealth? I forget the statistic on there, but it's dumbfounding. But that's what he's talking about here. That's what the word churl means. People that are hoarders of money, that are out just laying aside money, 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 gaining it, building it up, taking it away from everybody and building up their millions and millions. Well, they devise wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, even when the needy speaks right. But the noble devises liberal things, noble things, and by noble things he'll stand. Rise up, you women that are at ease. So now here he likens the nations of Israel to women at ease. Hear my voice, you careless daughters. Give ear to my speech. Many days and years shall you be troubled, you careless women, because the vintage will fail and the gathering will not come. So now God likens the nations of Israel to women. And that's a pretty good description when you think about Iran and the hostages over there and how firm we've been about it, you know, and how powerful we've been about it, you know. Let a little podunk country like that sit over there with hostages a year and a month and more. Well, no wonder God likens us to women that are at ease. Careless daughters, careless women. Tremble, you women that are at ease. Be troubled, you careless ones. Strip you and make you bare and gird sackcloth on your loins. They'll lament for the breast, or they'll smite themselves on the breast, in other words, saying, oh, woe is me, you know. That's poor translation there. They're striking themselves on the breast or the chest saying, what's happening to us? Woe is me. The pleasant fields are gone. The fruitful vine is gone. Trembling and troubled and careless. On the land of my people. That shows he's talking about nations of Israel. Thorns are going to come up and briars. Yea, on the houses of joy in the joyous city. In other words, instead of all the theaters and all the amusement areas and all the drinking, partying areas, houses of joy. That's a pretty good description, isn't it? And on those houses of joy, they're going to be destroyed, and on them is going to come up thorns and briars. In the joyous city, where people were there for parties and revelry and marrying and giving in marriage and eating and drinking and just revelry, because the palace shall be forsaken. Now, I don't know how long ago that happened. The palace, the capital of Israel, how long has it been forsaken? The multitude of the city shall be left. The forts and towers shall be for dens forever. A joy of wild asses. A pasture of flocks. In other words, describing the capitals of Israel forsaken, describing the cities desolate, describing the weaponry being dwelt in by animals, wild asses, until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high and the wilderness be a fruitful field. So now he comes back with restoration, beginning verse 15. The millennium begins to be described through the end of the chapter. So over and over again, he tells you about the sin and the punishment and then the restoration. So how long is the palace going to be forsaken? How long is the land going to be barren with wild animals dwelling in it? Well, till conversion comes, till Christ comes back and begins to pour out the Spirit on all of his people regathered from on high. Then the wilderness will be a fruitful field. Then the fruitful field will be counted for a forest. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness will remain in the fruitful field. In other words, we'll follow God's judgments on agriculture and the way of life and everything else. There will be an end to the wildernesses, and the deserts will blossom like a rose and be turned into productivity and fruitfulness. Judgment shall dwell in the wilderness. Righteousness shall remain in the fruitful field. We'll leave areas that we don't glean and follow the laws of God in giving and farming. The work of righteousness shall be peace. The effect of righteousness, quietness, and assurance forever. So from that time forward, there's not going to be an end of righteousness and peace, and my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation and in sure dwellings and in quiet resting places. There again, a millennial rest, a thousand-year rest for God's people. When it shall hail, coming down on the forest, the city shall be low in a low place. Blessed are you that sow beside all waters, that send forth there the feet of the ox and the ass. Well, chapter 33 is fairly long, so we better not try to launch into that one. Isaiah 33, again, he starts off with another one of the woes. Here he's talking about a spoiler. Woe to you that spoilest, and you were not spoiled. You dealt treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with you. When you'll cease to spoil, you'll be spoiled. So here he's talking about the future punishment on the nations that are going to be used in punishing Israel, and then how Israel is going to gain all the accumulation of material things that they store up as a financial foundation beginning the millennium. So when you shall cease to spoil, you'll be spoiled. When you make an end to deal treacherously, then you'll be dealt treacherously with. The only hope God will have of destroying the destroyers and stopping men from annihilating people off the earth. And then as if looking up to God and praying and saying to God, O Eternal, be gracious to us. We've waited for you. Be you their arm every morning. Of course, an arm is just the strength, the help of Israel. God is the right arm, our salvation, also in the time of trouble. At the noise of the tumult, here talking about God's thunder and earthquake and all the powers of his return, at the noise of the tumult, the peoples fled. And here the word people should be plural, and it shows actually the nations that make up this Assyrian power is going to be a multiple of nations and nationalities, not just one. So at the noise of the angels and all of the noise at Christ's return, all of these peoples that have gathered there spoiling and fighting are going to flee. When God lifts up himself to intervene and no longer just sits back and allows man to go his way, at the lifting up of yourself, nations were scattered, and your spoil, here he's referring once again back to the beast power, the Assyrians, their spoil is going to be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar, just completely, totally taken, like locusts or caterpillars devour. As the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon the spoils that these nations of Europe have accumulated together. The Eternal is exalted, so here he goes right back once again to Christ's return and intervention and taking over. The Eternal is exalted because he dwells on high, and then when he does that, he has filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. So, another verse about the millennium. And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of your times. So man's times have been just the opposite. Confusion and injustice and all kinds of turmoil and trouble. But God's times are going to be wisdom and knowledge, the stability of God's time, strength of salvation. So once again, he's talking about salvation being open to people and being made known. The fear of the Eternal, that's his treasure. So people are going to be enlightened and come to understand salvation and walk in the fear of the only God, the true God. And now he goes back to the desolation at the time of the fall of Israel and the beast power. In verse 7, 8, 9, he says, Behold, their valiant one shall cry without. The ambassadors of peace that Israel has sent down to try to buy lovers, to try to ward off this power of Europe, they're going to weep bitterly because their alliances are going to fail and people are going to turn against Israel. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceases because the king of Assyria has broken the covenant. He's despised the cities, the strongholds of Judah, and he doesn't regard any man. And the earth mourns and languishes at the time when this power is about to take over the whole world. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness. Bashan and Carmel cast their fruits. Of course, here, the wealthiest, richest areas of Judah, Sharon, Bashan, Carmel, of course, Lebanon just to the north. Then he comes back again to Christ's return and intervention. Now I'll rise, says the Eternal. Now I'll be exalted. Now I'll lift up myself. So that's quite a common way of writing in prophecy. You jump back and forth, back and forth. You go back to the time at hand, and then you jump ahead into the future and what it's going to be like. It's almost as if you're having a dialogue talking back and forth. So now God says once again, answering their prayer in verse 2, Now I'll rise, says the Eternal. Now I'll be exalted. Now I'll lift up myself. The enemy, you're going to conceive chaff, you're going to bring forth stubble. So God is going to come as a consuming fire, and all these powers of men that gather together are just conceiving chaff and bringing forth stubble, then God's breath, like fire, is going to end up devouring this chaff and stubble. The peoples are going to be as the burnings of lime, and that's rather poorly translated. He's talking about the fuel that's used in the lime kilns, and basically they burnt thorns, as he says in the next part of this verse, as a part of the real hot heat for the lime pits or the lime kilns. The peoples shall be as the burnings. Notice they're going to be like the thorns and wood and the material that's used to burn and heat up the making of bricks. Or as thorns cut up, they'll be burned in the fire. So now he brings in the destructiveness of fire, and he's going to show you how, what kind of a fire God is. Hear you that are far off, the heathen nations, the nations that are going against God's people. Hear you that are far off what I have done, and you that are near, acknowledge my might. So all the nations, whether near or far, are going to end up seeing what God does. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? And of course, other places God says our God is a consuming fire. You might want to notice Psalm 15. He's asking the same type questions as there in Isaiah 33. Who among us shall dwell? Who will be able to stand? And in Psalm 15 he says, Eternal, who shall abide in your tabernacle? Who will dwell in your holy hill? Well, someone that walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. One that doesn't backbite with his tongue or do evil to his neighbor, that doesn't take up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a vile person is loathed or despised, but he honors those that fear the Eternal, someone that will swear to his own hurt and not change and perform what he's sworn, he that doesn't put out his money to usury or doesn't take up reward against the innocent, he that does these will never be moved. So that's tying right in with verse 14 and 15 here. He's asking a question. Who among us won't have to run and hide and flee? Who among us will be able to dwell when God comes back as a devouring fire? Not an ever-burning fire, but a devouring fire. And when God likens beings that are going to be devoured with the fire, he doesn't liken them to asbestos or rocks or stone or granite. He likens them to thorns and chaff and straw. Very quickly burn, very fast fires and hot heat. But who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? He that walks righteously and speaks uprightly, he that despises the gain of fraud or cheats, of deceits, that shakes his hands from holding of bribes, that stops his ears from hearing anybody planning somebody else's death or murders or wars, anyone that shuts his eyes from seeing evil, he that dwells on high, his place of defense shall be the munitions of rocks, bread shall be given him, his water shall be sure. Your eyes shall see the king in his beauty. They shall behold the land that's very far off. And that doesn't mean that it's far off as in verse 13, but this means that stretches way out, that stretches on and on, stretches for a distance. So here he's talking about the return of Christ again in verse 17. He's not up in the third heaven anymore. Your eyes shall see the king in his beauty. So Christ has come back and on Zion and ruling out of Zion. And then the land that he inherits and takes over is spread way out, as the promised land should have been in the beginning. They'll behold the land that's very far off, stretches way beyond what they conquered in their past. Your heart shall meditate. In other words, you'll look back and remember those bad days of besieging and trouble. But then you'll say, where is the counter? The count of the people as they were taken and delivered into slavery. Where is the receiver, or the weigher, the person that figured the value of all the captives? Where is he that counted the towers, looking at the fortresses of resistance? As So instead of looking back and meditating, you shall not see a fierce people, a people of a deeper speech than you can perceive. So here it always talks about the power there of the Assyrians as being a different tongue, a different language. You'll not see the fierce people that you meditate of in your heart in terror, verse 18. But you'll not see those people of that different tongue, a tongue that's hard for you to speak, that you can't understand. Look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Here again is a reference to holy days. The very word solemnities goes back to Leviticus 23 and Numbers 15, talking about the solemn assemblies. That was on Zion. And now he says, think about the comparison of Zion, a city of festivals. Your eyes shall see Jerusalem, the quiet habitation, a tabernacle that will not be taken down. So instead of just coming in and dwelling for 8 days and then taking your tabernacle and leaving, this word isn't the word sukkah here. This is the word for tent. So Zion's going to be permanent. It'll be a 1,000-year festival attitude or atmosphere. So you won't have Zion as a place of temporary tents that are there 8 days and then taken down. But your eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. So that's going to be the permanent tabernacle area for joy and happiness and a festive attitude, and not just for 8 days. But there, the glorious eternal will be unto us as a place of broad rivers. Of course, the mount splitting in the middle and living water going out, both literally and spiritually. So the glorious eternal is going to be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams, wherein shall go no galley with oars, no more warring of ships and captives, captors, invaders. None of them will be around or allowed in these new rivers of Israel. For the eternal is our judge. The eternal is our lawgiver. The eternal is our king. When the Bible writes it that way, instead of just saying the eternal is our judge, lawgiver, and king, it's doing that for greater emphasis, repeating whole terms over and over. The eternal is our judge. The eternal is our lawgiver. The eternal is our king. He will save us. Their tacklings are loose. They couldn't well strengthen their mast. They couldn't spread the sail. In other words, no more fear of invaders, no more fear of military difficulties pictured here as ships attacking a coastland. So they're going to be thwarted from their attempts. Then is the prey of a great spoil divided, the lamb takes the prey. In other words, when Christ comes back and intervenes and takes over the wealth of the heathen, it'll be easy so much that even anybody that would be like lame would still be able to take the spoil. And the inhabitant shall not say, I am sick. The people that dwell therein shall be forgiven their iniquity. Here again, Hebrew word is avon, A-V-O-N, and their sin of their nature, the vanity of their very being. So God is going to heal the sickness of the people. They're not going to be sick spiritually or physically anymore.